Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
This is Buzz Beat, member of Almighty Baller Radio and hosted by Spencer and Richie.
All right, welcome back, Buzz Beat listeners, Queen City Hoop readers, and Hornets fans everywhere. The playoff chances for the Hornets are now officially dead, and the season is all but over, but there is still plenty to talk about, and Handles Randall and I are here to bring that to you. Don't forget that we are a member of the Almighty Baller Podcast Network. Please make sure that you're checking out all of the awesome NBA coverage over at almightyballer.com. Richie, the Hornets are officially in the draft lottery, my friend. Your gut reaction to that?
My gut reaction is that's not really what I expected as we enter the season. I predicted for us to, you know, end up with less wins, but still make it into the playoffs, even at that sixth spot. If you look at the standings right now, the Bucks have 41 wins, are in the playoffs, and currently sitting in the sixth spot. So logistically, that could have worked out for us. You know, we had 48 wins last year. Did not expect that to happen this year, but I did expect us to make it to the playoffs. So logistically, we could have ended up with less wins and slid into the playoffs. You know, 5, 6, 7 in that range. Obviously, beginning of the year, I thought, you know, we could compete for a top four spot. If you were to tell me that we were lottery bound, you know, beginning of the season, I would have been a little skeptical. But as the season progressed, it was looking more and more like that was going to happen. With the injuries, the lack of depth, I think by the end of February is kind of when I knew that that's where we were going to be headed. I know others kind of held out hope as the season progressed. We actually had a little bit of a push towards the end of the season. But my gut reaction is that's not what I expected to begin the season. And as the season progressed, it did seem like it was more and more of a possibility that that's where we were headed. But the issue was we pushed for that playoff spot. And I wish we kind of would have played ourselves out of that playoff spot and into a better draft position. But, you know, last thing I'll say on that is that the Hornets would have never done that. So,
no, they wouldn't have. And, you know, we've discussed that plenty. But you got to give this team credit. The resurrection was real. I mean, until this past week where they lose three straight and play themselves out of the picture, they had won 7 of 9 previous to that. So, you know, credit to those guys and Coach Cliff and to just keep fighting. And they're still fighting. You know, they fought yesterday against Boston and probably should have won that game and certainly gave themselves a good chance and a big comeback. But they're playing hard and they're just extremely flawed. I mean, this roster is flawed. They're in cap hell. I mean, this just get used to it because these are the guys the Hornets fans are going to have to ride or die with for the next two or three seasons. And it's just, you know, it's just the construction and the makeup of this team, and we're a little bit stuck. But different conversation for a different day. Richie, let's get into last week's action. Competitive, Hornets have a chance to win two or three of those games. The Miami game always felt out of reach, but the Washington game, let's start there. Washington wins. This was Tuesday night, 118-111. Hornets are up by 12 at halftime. Definitely outplayed the Wiz in the first half, and you know, I thought for the beginning of the third quarter, but boy, oh boy, when Washington got it going from deep and when they were able to speed that game up and get Wall out into the open floor and get Charlotte moving faster than they're comfortable moving, you can see the blueprint of a Wizards team that they could definitely start playing the right ball at the right time of the year, I think. And I think that's a team that could beat Cleveland. But anyways, let's talk about this game. Richie, again, I thought it got away from the Hornets when the game sped up. 16 turnovers, too much for Charlotte. And then Washington gets it going from deep.
Yeah, we both noticed that in the game where they sped the game up. And that's not really our style. I mean, we do like to transition off turnovers at times and spurts. But overall, we're not a fast-paced team. But when we tried to keep pace with the Wizards, it just didn't work. And Wall is very, very good in transition. You know, he will pull up from the mid-range or take it all the way to the basket. So he's a very difficult guard. And I always felt that Kemba never really played well against Washington, and especially Wall because of his size. But he played very, very good against this Washington team, dropping 37 points and shot the ball very efficiently from the field. Cody had a very good game, and he always plays well against the Wizards. He averages 15-7 against the Wizards and had 10-10 on that night. But like you said, the upped pace, we just couldn't keep up with. And when the third quarter and fourth quarter came, you know, the three-point shooting from the Wizards kind of ramped up a little bit. And, you know, think about this. The season average, Washington Wizards averaged 9 three-pointers made and 25 three-pointers attempted. In the second half alone, they were 10 for 17. So, again, we'll talk about this later in the show, but just our inability to defend that line has become an issue all season, really.
Yeah, it's been a huge issue. You know, and you just, again, we got Washington out into their comfort zone, you know, in transition, got them open looks from behind the arc. So, you know, not that Charlotte doesn't already give up enough open looks, you know, from three, but certainly in transition, it's going to be hard to defend that accurately. But I thought Nick Batum, when he had to kind of run the second unit, he has a few very crucial turnovers there in that third quarter. And that seemed to me to really spark the run for them. Miles Plumlee had a crucial turnover too. But so in the end, you know, the Hornets just get outplayed in the second half. At that point, the playoff chances aren't dead. You know, as we transition into the very next night, where the Hornets came home against Miami, but my goodness, they ran into a buzzsaw that was a Heat team. That, you know, I don't know that it would have mattered if Charlotte was defending the 3-point line that night, because Miami was throwing everything in. They made 21 threes, so they make 21 of 40 on the night. James Johnson goes crazy. Goran Dragic goes crazy. This team, I can't believe the job Eric Spoelstra has done with this ragtag group. I mean, Rodney Magruder, you know, starts for them. It's amazing. You know, I did not know James Johnson was even capable of being this kind of guy. And he has absolutely murdered the Hornets in every single game this season. We cannot match up with him. But you got to give this Heat team credit, Richie. They fight. They play together. They guard. They've got a guy down low that you can send all your defensive action to, Hassan Whiteside, and he can clean it up. But, you know, it's fun to watch an NBA team that is driven, that has a goal, that plays on both ends, that is just kind of tougher than you are. And I think that's who Miami is. And Charlotte learned that the hard way on Wednesday.
Yeah, I mean, from a roster standpoint, their roster isn't necessarily better than ours. I wouldn't even say it is. I mean, they do have some good players and Goran Dragic, and he's been playing well lately. They got Whiteside. James Johnson, like you said, always kills us. But overall, their roster should not be a roster in which they are still in playoff contention. While we're eliminated, they are still in playoff contention. So, yeah, you got to give credit to Spo. He's a great coach. You know, I've always kind of thought that even when he had LeBron on his team, he never got the credit that he deserved. But now you can see kind of, you know, how he's working with this team with less talent. And, you know, Winslow's out for the year. He's had to deal with that for most of the year. So this Miami team is still competing and still in the race for the playoffs. But, yeah, this game, we felt less in control of this game than we did the Washington game. And that lead kind of ballooned in the second half, right after halftime with our starters. So, yeah, give credit to Spo.
Yeah, just a lot of shot making for Miami. I mean, they make, you know, they create a lot of offense as Goran, you know, everything runs through Goran Dragic. And he's had, you know, sneakily an all-NBA, you know, flirting with an all-NBA year. I mean, his numbers are crazy good this year, kind of back to Phoenix, Goran Dragic. But, you know, everything runs through him. He's a really smart player. When he gets it going offensively, when he sees his shot go in, Richie, that pick and roll action with Whiteside becomes so much harder to defend, because now you got to step up on Dragic. You can't sit back with your big, and now you're allowing Whiteside to you know, get a head start running at the rim, which creates your help defense to have to come over even more. And so that happened right away because Dragic got it going early in the game. And we saw this in the seven-game playoff series last year. I mean, there's a few games where he really struggled, but for the most part in that series, he was pretty good. And it just made that pick-and-roll situation with Whiteside almost impossible to negotiate defensively. And the Hornets just – they had no defensive scheme answer for that Heat team on Wednesday night. And it was really hard to watch. And on top of that, the Hornets just weren't good offensively. They finished 8 of 25 from behind the arc on the game. Take care of the ball, you know, don't really beat themselves per se, but they just couldn't match Miami's offensive efficiency and onslaught there. Nick Batum played pretty well, which he also did last night against Boston. So kind of nice to see Nick get going here.
Yep.
At the end of the season, but you know, it's too late. So we should have figured that he would show up now, but,
exactly.
Yeah, you know, it's like, of course you're going to play good now. Richie, anything else that really sticks out about this game outside of the Hornets just not having an answer for Miami's offense?
No, I mean, I forgot to mention this. This, I think, happened in the third quarter. There was a technical called on Whiteside. And for like the next, I would say, 10 possessions, he was just a beast. You know, he that kind of sparked his effort, his energy. And we saw earlier in the year when we played against him, like, he just seemed out of it. Sometimes it takes something like this for him to actually get into the game mentally. But they, Miami went on a run in the third quarter, and a lot of it was due to him and his energy and that technical foul that was called on him. Can't remember exactly when in the third quarter, but I just remember that vividly happening. And then from then on out, it was pretty much all over in that game.
You know, I got to give Hassan Whiteside a lot of credit. I was not a proponent of really anybody paying him, you know, a max salary. The Heat, you know, they took a chance. He got his big deal. This year was the first year of that deal. You know, he'll be making almost $28 million in the 19-20 season. But, you know, Richie, his effort has become more consistent this year. He's less of a baby. It seems like he's pouting less. Just feels like he wants to be out there playing the game and plays with passion. And when a guy like that, I mean, he's built unlike very many centers in the league. It can do things, protect the rim, unlike many guys in this entire league. You know, if he plays with that kind of energy and that kind of passion, I mean, he can definitely become the most impactful defensive center in the entire NBA. And we've seen that guy in spots this year. I think we definitely saw him Wednesday night. Miami's got something cooking down there. You know, it's a little bit of a flawed roster, but they go into free agency. I think they're going to have some money to spend here. If they nail another draft pick, which they've been good at in the past, feels like it's not going to take them long to recover from the LeBron James days. But all right, so let's move on to last night, the Boston game. Hornets were not officially dead in the playoff hunt going into this game, but they do lose to the Celtics 121-114 in a game that they had to. They made an 18-point comeback, Richie? 19-point comeback.
In
the second half to take the lead by 7, really, with about 6 minutes left in that game. They were up 104-97 after Marvin Williams' triple. And then it just really seemed to go south from there. Isaiah Thomas happened.
Yeah, exactly. And he did not have like this an amazing fourth quarter like he has had against us in the past. I believe he scored 9 in the fourth, which is still good, which is still great. And he, you could definitely feel his impact in the game, especially late in that game. You know, he's tough to guard because even though he's small, he does finish very well around the basket. And we saw that on a couple occasions late in the game, you know, up with Zeller and all the bigs around him. He's still able to finish, and he's very quick when he gets to the rim. So, you know, he'll either shoot the three, but if you close out hard on him, he's going to cut to the basket. And even with his size, he can finish, you know, amongst the trees in that restricted area. So, yeah, Isaiah Thomas did happen. Avery Bradley also had a good fourth quarter. I believe he scored 10 or 11 points in the fourth quarter. And, you know, he killed us earlier in the year. I think it was on the home opener. So we kind of bookend our season with a home opener and a home finale against Boston. Both happened to be losses. I guess the one positive that you have to take away from this game is Nick. I mean, I think this is one of his best games he's had in a while. You know, he was efficient and had a complete game from beginning to end. You know, I think in the OKC game and the Washington game, he had strong starts, but he kind of disappeared in the second half. This one, he was consistent from quarter one to quarter four. So he had 31 points, 8 rebounds, 3 assists. And the big thing is he only had 1 turnover, which is, you know, crazy. Crazy to hear out of Nick Batum.
Yeah, Batum had an excellent game yesterday. I mean, definitely one of his best of the season. And your point that you just ended on there, I mean, you know, just 1 turnover, really incredible for him. Only 3 assists, but both of those numbers, 1 turnover, 3 assists, they both tell me one thing, that, you know, he was locked in offensively. He was aggressive offensively. He was looking for a shot. He was not hesitant. You know, I don't know how, you know, he gets there as a player, but that has to be more of Nick Batum's mindset moving forward. You know, we'll see if the Hornets, you know, end up adding a real 2-guard shooting guard and slide him over to the 3, which I think at this point, Richie, just about every fan that keeps up with the Hornets, watches Nick Batum play, would agree. We got to slide him to 3. But, you know, he has to look for his shot. He has to look to score more on this team. He's already naturally a good passer. He's already, you know, he already sees the floor very well naturally, but, you know, it's this hesitancy offensively that, you know, it affects the rest of the team. You know, it affects the synergy on the court offensively for the rest of this group. So he's really got to have more mindset like he had yesterday. 11 of 23 from the field, 4 of 8 from behind the arc, gets to the free throw line 7 times. 31 points, so a big game for Batum.
It's almost like Whiteside, you know, in a way. I mean, not that he has the upside that Whiteside has, but just his mindset. Like, he'll go through, you know, a game where he has aggression in quarter one and quarter two, and then he'll just kind of fall off. And that's why we kind of were tentative about giving him the ball late in the games, because you just never know if he'll turn the ball over, if he gets passive all of a sudden. But against Boston, I mean, he was on, and he did not look to pass the ball. Because he was staying aggressive, and that's what we've come to expect out of him, especially when he signed that big contract. So we wish this happened on a consistent basis, and a consistent basis, and not the third to last game of the year.
Yeah, no doubt about that. But you know, nonetheless, I think a good sign going into next year. You know, it's in there. You just, again, to your point, you just hope that he finds some way to make it more consistent. But you know, back to the Isaiah Thomas topic there at the end of the game. You know, he's a load to deal with. I think I would have liked Charlotte. I would like to seen them defensively be a little bit more aggressive with him. And what I mean by that is, you know, on those pick and rolls, just go ahead and blitz him. You know, trap him, get the ball out of his hands, make somebody else beat you. You know that Thomas is going to get the ball at the end of the game, and you know that the chances are that guy's going to take it. He's going to be taking the shot, whether that's driving to the rim. Or if, you know, if the big is sitting a little bit low on the pick and roll, he's going to let it go. So I would have liked the Hornets to be a little bit more aggressive with him offensively and make somebody else on Boston beat them. They were not. He hits, I think, 2 threes there late, gets to the rim one time. And Richie, you were saying he's a good finisher for his size at the rim. He's just so good at using, you know, getting the defender on his hip and using his body to leverage the angle. You know, so he can get his shot up, and he's good at getting all the way under the rim, getting the defender on one side of his body or the other, and using the other side of the rim almost as a shield, right? As a defender,
right?
So he can get his shot up. Kimba's good at this too, but Isaiah Thomas is excellent at this, and he really makes a living off of that. But you know, it's frustrating though, because I thought the Hornets could have been more aggressive with him and potentially had a chance to pull that game out. They were not, and he burns them late in that game to kind of close it out.
They basically ran the same play on like 5 consecutive possessions. They had this horn set where they would come up a double high screen with Horford and Bradley, and they would run off that screen. And Zeller, who was guarding Horford at the time, like you said, he wouldn't like hedge hard. He would kind of sag off because he knew that the drive was coming. Bradley would roll out and pop for 3, so he was an option. But yeah, the attention was on Thomas, but it wasn't necessarily aggressive. They were just kind of contain him in the paint. But by that point, Kimba couldn't catch up, and he got all the way to the basket and made it. But we left Avery Bradley wide open for 3. So we did give him that option. But I guess it's just so hard to defend Boston because they do have shooters around him.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Zeller, is what he's doing is he's just like you're describing. He's guarding that ball screen. he's guarding it flat. So his butt is parallel with the baseline.
Yep.
You know, really the other option, and what I'm talking about, that I would probably rather have seen, and Clifford has done this in the past, not often, but he's done it, is get Zeller to come out and now his to where his chest is parallel with the sideline. And so he's meeting Thomas face to face, you know, as he comes off that screen. Obviously Kimba is trailing his hip, so now you have a natural trap
right
there. And Thomas has either got to split it, or he's got to, you know, he's got to dribble back, crab dribble backwards to create space, or he's got to give it up. Now any of those options are fine. Well, not splitting it. You don't want to allow him to split it, but you know, the other two, crab dribble back or pitch it somewhere else, that's what you want. And I think, Richie, let's see what Boston faces in the playoffs and how the matchups work out. But I can guarantee you, if you get an Eastern Conference Finals matchup of Cleveland and Boston, that's how Cleveland's going to guard that action. They're going to make sure it gets out of his hand, and they're going to use the same approach they used with Steph Curry. You know, in the finals these last few years, they're going to trap that action, get it out of his hands. I mean, we're not talking about a situation with Charlotte and Clifford in a defensive scheme that the Hornets have to execute over an entire game. We're just talking about the end of games. You know, make somebody else beat you. And a little bit frustrating for me. You know, the Hornets, you know, I don't want to get into this huge, large defensive conversation, but we can have it for a minute. You know, Clifford's a good defensive coach, and I think he's a good coach overall, but he's not willing to adjust very often, and he's not willing to try new things as often as maybe I think he should be. And I think this Isaiah Thomas conversation, how we defend this pick and roll action, I think it's a perfect example. I think, to me, with this group that we have currently rostered, in a group that we're going to see for the next few seasons because the Hornets are locked in, he's going to have to get creative, Richie, on that end of the floor. You know, we've all talked about, and you're going to talk about later, how the Hornets are going to have to become better at guarding the three-point line. They have to. You know, in this situation right here, we're talking about, you know, at the end of the game, getting creative on how you're going to guard a pick-and-roll situation against one of the best guards in the entire league, probably going to be an all-NBA first team, it's probably second team player in Isaiah Thomas. I mean, these are the kind of things that you got to get creative. You got to think outside of the box. You got to get yourself a little bit out of the comfort zone as a coach, right? And try different things. And he just hasn't shown that he's willing to do that, Richie. And I want your thoughts on that a little bit.
It's almost like he's a low risk type of coach. You know, the things that we were talking about just then about how to defend Isaiah Thomas at the end of games, it's kind of like a high risk, high reward type of deal. If you do hedge hard with Cody Zeller, you do give up that, you know, option that he could split that screen and make it an easier shot at the rim. Even if, you know, he would rather almost have us contain him and at least have bodies around him. But you're exactly right. He doesn't adjust on the fly. And to be honest with you, he doesn't really adjust throughout the season. It's almost like he's got to sit down after the season and think about, okay, what went wrong? How can we adjust? And that's kind of always been his thing. And he just seems like a very conservative coach when it comes to that, you know. But, you know, he might need to make a high-risk, high-reward type of move, especially with our roster. We don't have great individual defenders.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree that, you know, the actual talent defensively on the roster is not high. And, you know, I touched on this a little bit last week. You know, you can give Zeller credit for being, you know, an average to slightly above-average guy defending the rim, but he's not a rim protector.
No.
Right? Guys aren't – and what I mean by that, I know he does a good job of protecting the rim. And, you know, I mean, everyone – there's nothing I could say to that. I mean, I know the stats spit out, you know, the right kind of numbers. But what I'm telling you is that when a guy is driving at Cody Zeller, it's not going to make him think twice about going up or pitching it back. He's going to go at him. And so that ability for offenses to go at the rim – you know, with no hesitancy is a problem for Charlotte. And that creates this, you know, larger, you know, shell defense, over help, you know, help defenders sagging in too deep to the paint. You know, they need more than one guy, you know, towards the rim to persuade, you know, the offense from, you know, from heading there with the ball. So, you know, until Charlotte finds a guy who can legitimately kind of protect that area by himself, so to speak, in a lot of defensive situations, I don't know where Charlotte can be more aggressive defensively, and I don't know where they can extend to the 3-point line to try to clean up this problem with 3-point defense, you know. And but you know, it's all interesting, Richie. And what we're talking about is Coach Cliff really just not being willing to try new things, because I think there are other things that we could be trying, but it hasn't really happened yet. So anyways, that, I guess we're still in the Boston game. It went into a little bit of a different conversation there. Anything else as we kind of close the game that has officially put the Hornets, you know, out of the playoff race here?
No, I mean, again, you know, we're out of it. You know, we talked about how we kind of gave up on the season, but they did tempt us, you know, towards the end of the season here. And I kind of hope for these last two games, not sure it's actually going to happen, but we see more play time out of the younger players like Lamb and Kaminsky and Weber, and maybe even Travion Graham, just see, you know, a little bit of run out of them to see how they fit with our roster moving forward. Obviously, it's just going to be two games, but, you know, it might not be a big enough sample size. But, yeah, our season is over.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's a good point. You know, I'm interested to see, you know, Weber especially get some minutes, hopefully get some minutes down here at the end of the season. But who knows? You know, I would hope that Brian Roberts is done. I don't know what the point is to have him play in these last two games. But, yeah, Graham's going to see minutes, like you said, with Bellinelli. We're not sure what his status is. I doubt that he would play the remainder of the season.
Kimba, you know, injured his left leg late last night. And he walked off on his own power. So I don't know how significant this injury is. But he was coming off a screen and or defending a screen, I should say, and running through one, and he just kind of fell. And he was kind of holding his left leg, left knee, just kind of nursing that leg. But he walked off on his own power. He was able to walk back after the game in the locker room on his own power. So I don't think it's that significant. But again, in a somewhat meaningless game when we really have, you know, a slight chance of winning, making the playoffs, that would have sucked to have him go down on that type of injury. So again, we got two games that are definitely meaningless coming up. Let's try to limit the minutes from Kemba and Batum and MKG and everyone that has a future with us, and see what the young kids do.
Yeah, I don't even know why Kemba would put, like, if he plays in these last two games, I'll be a little bit pissed. Not a little bit. I will be pissed. Like, what's the point? You know, I've already made my case for him being shut down about a month ago, 3 weeks ago, and I stand by that. But now, like these last two games, why suit him up? What is the point? You depend on him for so much, night in, night out. I mean, gosh, incredibly, he's been, you know, healthy this season. But, you know, the guy has had numerous procedures on that knee. And you got to pick your spots here to get him some rest. If he plays in these last two games, Richie, yeah, that is a suicide mission for the Hornets. So it'll be interesting. You're officially out of the playoff race. Somebody please tell Michael Jordan, Rich Cho, and Steve Clifford there's nothing that, like,
maybe,
good for you.
Maybe
for
they think there's a ninth seed. Maybe they think there's a ninth seed.
Yeah, let's make sure we get the last lottery, you know, the last lottery slot here. That's more important than 13th. So let's make sure we're the 14th worst team in the league. It looks a lot better and says that we didn't tank. Unbelievable, Richie. All right. Let's get off this topic. All right, so let's talk about some individual stats. You pulled some. I pulled some the other night. Some interesting stuff when I start digging around, kind of on NBA.com, and NBA Wowie is also a good on-court, off-court site if you guys want to check that out, to find out how some of the lineups work for the Hornets and how some folks play together or don't play as well together. Let's start with just a general net rating. Richie, on the season, well, this was going into the game last night. Kemba's net rating on the season is 3.6. Not the highest on the team, second highest. Batum is 1.5, which is much more modest average net rating. And I want to talk about Batum here for a minute. Not a good season for him. Certainly regressed overall. Shoots about 40% from the field, 33% from behind the arc. His assist and turnover numbers are effectively the exact same as last year, so he's still flirting with about 3 turnovers a game, just shy of that, really. But we did not see him make a jump this year. Richie, what I want to ask you, and then we'll talk about some other numbers here, is this 15 points a game, 6 rebounds, you know, 5 assists, is this the guy that the Nick Batum that we're going to see for the rest of his career, or do you, is there an uptick left in his progression as a player?
I think there could be an uptick in points and assists, and obviously to kind of limit those turnovers. But I think that, you know, his actually per game stats, you know, slightly, but they went up from last year. But the issue with Batum has been his shooting percentages. You know, nothing, you know, jaw dropping here, but his catch and shoot numbers and his pull up numbers were all, you know, if you look at them, they all favored last year compared to this year. So his shooting percentages went down. So in terms of per game stats, I don't mind if he has, you know, 15, 16 points a game, six assists a game. That's fine. But I think his shooting percentages and his turnovers got ahead in the right direction. So if you're our second option, you can't be turning the ball over that much because we can't rely on you late in games. And if you're a second option, you can't have a continuous dip in your shooting percentages. I think one thing that has inflated his stats this year, because obviously his points went up, assists, rebounds, turnovers, and all that, you know, slightly, but it did. I think his biggest thing is that Batum actually did a good job of, you know, legit or not, was he was able to draw fouls off screens, especially in the three-point range. 21% of his points came off of free throws this year. That's up from 16% from last year. So did these inflate his stats? Probably. So, you know, a lot of his points come from the free throw line, not from the actual, you know, floor. So you can't really count on the refs always bailing you out and giving you that call. So the biggest thing is, yes, I can see an uptick in those points per game, assists, rebounds, and what have you, but I think the shooting percentages is kind of where I would want to focus on.
That has certainly been, you know, an area of his offensive game that he's improved in. He's shown us something we hadn't really seen before. And it started, Richie, with, you know, coming off the screen at the three-point line. You know, when he's got a guy trailing him, almost like he's got his, you know, the defender's got a hand on Batum's hip. You know, he got really good at getting into his shot motion and earning an abnormal amount of, you know, three-point free throw attempts. And Bellinelli got really good at that too. But yeah, Batum slowly as the year, that kind of progressed into, you know, him posting up more, which we saw him do yesterday against Avery Bradley a few times. Really, in these last two games, Richie, he has drawn fouls off of post-up, you know, post-up opportunities where he has a smaller defender guarding him. Now, I think you would agree with me that he's not a good post player. You know, that's right. Not a part of his game. You know, outside of drawing a foul, he's just gonna, you know, he's gonna catch it against a smaller defender. He's gonna fade. Take one or two, you know, dribbles back. Exactly right, and then he's gonna fade. Which just tells me it's just his bailout move. He's developed no kind of post game where he can spin to his right hand or spin to his left hand and go straight up at the rim. You know, he's just kind of stuck to the floor in that way. So, you know, that is an aspect of his game that I think he can improve. But what saves him was your initial point that he gets to the free throw line and he's gotten really good at getting in, almost flipping into a shot motion when he feels the defender's hand on his hip, on his back, wherever it might be, kind of spins his elbows into that hand and earns the foul. But you're right. That stuff, you can't depend on it, right? Like, you actually have to develop some real offensive moves that you can go to, you know, especially if you expect to be a team that competes and goes in the playoffs. That, you know, you're not going to get away with that kind of garbage. You right. You got to play basketball. You got to make shots, you know, and just making shots more consistently. Is something that's extremely important for Nick Batum. I would say to this conversation is, and kind of this question I presented, that I think this is the Nick Batum that we're basically going to see for the remainder of his career. I see where areas that he could improve, and I know how he could do that. I'm not sure that it's going to happen, though. You know, Nick Batum goes about the game of basketball in a very, very meticulous way. And he in his mind, he puts so much emphasis on trying to draw fouls and kind of play the game. And yeah, I don't want to beat him up here, but kind of play the way in a gimmicky way, if you will. You know, and that's a mindset thing. And I don't know that changes enough to where we see a Nick Batum, you know, have a year where he shoots 45% from behind the arc and, you know, develops a game where he's catching it around the block against smaller defenders and really punishing them and, you know, an average in 20 points a game. I don't know that we're ever going to see that guy. I mean, that was the guy that you know, NBA fans for a decade have been, you know, hoping for from Batum. I mean, the potential was always certainly there with his length and his, you know, and his passing ability and the way he saw the floor. And he's just a versatile player. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, this is kind of what he is.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I mean, I guess I'm content with it in terms of his per game stats, but I'm not content with it when it comes to his shooting percentages. And going back to the your point about the post ups and how he likes to fade and dribble away, and he'll take advantage of smaller defenders when that's the case, but that's not part of his game. But I wonder if it goes back to his mindset. He's not aggressive. He's not going to try to I mean, not that he would bully anyone, but like he's not going to try to attack the basket when he's in that post up situation. So again, kind of goes back to his mindset overall. He's got a very, I wouldn't say a passive game, but I mean, he does play passive at times. So I think that's probably part of the reason why he's not ever developed that post-up game, because he probably doesn't want to be down there.
Yeah, yeah, right. So on the other side of the floor, you know, I ran some some numbers. When Kaminsky and Batum shared the floor on the defensive end, opponents shot 51.5% from the floor and almost 37% from behind the arc, 36.7. So, you know, certainly, you know, eye-popping, very bothersome defensive numbers. Batum, we've talked about this before, he cannot stay in front of his defender. You know, one thing that certainly is not going to change is Batum has slow feet. It's kind of athlete he is. He's never been an incredible athlete, never will be.
Yeah, but if he gets out of his upright stance, you can move a little bit quicker, wouldn't you think?
No, correct. Yeah, I mean, you're right. If he commits to actually playing harder on that end, gets in a stance, you know, decides he's going to move his feet, you know, play a little bit off of the guy that he's guarding. That should always be part of his game plan because, number one, he can't move his feet very well. Number two, he has length to kind of make up for being able to play a little bit farther off. But if the Hornets expect a return to being a top five or top 10 defense, you know, it's going to mean that Nick Batum has to be more committed on that end of the floor. You're absolutely right, Richie. I expect this to be a big time topic of conversation between Batum and Clifford, maybe even Rich Joe this offseason, because this stuff for him just, I mean, I could go by that guy pretty easily right now. I mean, he has no interest in trying to keep the ball in front of him. And is like a magnet for ball screens. I mean, he just melts on ball screens. There's got to be more of a commitment on that end of the floor if the Hornets, you know, expect to return, like I said, to a top 10 defense. But yeah, when him and Kaminsky share the floor, back to that original stat, it's the sea, it's the Red Sea parting. I mean, whatever you want offensively as an opponent, got it.
Yeah, both of those players are very similar in the way that they defend or they don't defend. Their stances are just not existent. Batum does have a little bit more, I guess, upside when it comes to defending. I mean, Kaminsky, I have a little less hope with him because he's so lanky and big and kind of like oafy, you know what I mean? But at least Batum, if he gets down, he can use his length to his advantage, but like we've talked about all season, it's a want-to factor, and he doesn't have that want-to factor, especially on the defensive end.
Correct. And then on the offensive end, you know, really, I found it interesting. It didn't get much better with these two. When they shared the floor together, they both had under a 50% effective field goal rate, which is not good, not good at all. So really, it was the perfect storm when Kaminsky and Batum shared the floor on both ends, and the Hornets were not able to survive that lineup, including those two players, in any kind of consistent basis this year. Certainly going to be a topic of conversation moving into the future. You know, and you're right, it is more Kaminsky than Batum. Batum's not a great defender, but he's better than Kaminsky. Where do you play Kaminsky? What lineups is he best in? You know, what I think with Zeller, you know, we talked about, I think that kind of steadies the water where you can get a little bit out of Kaminsky offensively, kind of present that stretch the floor threat, and then it's easier to hide him defensively than putting him at the five and asking him to have to negotiate all those pick and roll coverages and guard a guy that's bigger than him. And just to ask him move less, to move defensively less, makes a lot of sense, and that's why, you know, maybe he is just a better fit as a power forward for the Hornets. If he's going to maximize his potential as a player, we've talked about this before, I think he needs to be a five, but I'm not sure that's a possibility for him in this league. So I think the question has been answered that, you know, if Kaminsky's going to be on the floor at all, and he's going to be productive and you're going to be good as a team on both ends, probably means he's going to have to be out there as a four.
Right.
All right. So clearly the best guy in terms of net rating on this team was Cody Zeller this season. And when Kemba and Zeller shared the floor, they were plus 7.8, the best on the team, two-man combination, not even close. When those two guys are on the floor, Richie, and we saw this last year, the offense is different. The defense is more connected. You know, Zeller with his screen assist, with his ability to roll to the rim hard, he just opens up so many options for Kemba, and the offense was excellent with those two on the floor.
Yeah, and I should have said this midseason. I was thinking it, but I was almost hesitant to say it. When we gave out our midseason awards, I had Batum number two and Zeller number three. But in my mind, I think Zeller was the second best player on our team this season. And I think it has shown as the season progressed that he has. I mean, his importance to this team could be seen when he was gone. It could be seen when he was here. You obviously, like you know, you said, the screen assist. I think he's third in the league when it comes to per game screen assist. And him and Kemba played well together because Kemba, you know, he ran the pick and roll at a high frequency, 55% frequency. That's a top 10 in the NBA. And he averaged 12 points a game, Kemba, that is, off of pick and roll situations. That's a league's best. So those two play together very well because they do a lot of the same things in terms of they work well together. You know, Zeller is the one that's setting the screen. Kemba is the one that is coming off that screen. And as Kemba has progressed throughout the years, he has become more difficult. Now, Zeller, I don't think he did as good a job as finishing off that pick and roll this season as he did last season. But what we did see this season was the way that he was able to dish the ball after receiving that pick and roll. And the Hornets had a 19% assist ratio, which is when Zeller was on the court. So that's second best on the team. So when he was on the court, the 19% of the Hornets made field goals were assisted. And that doesn't necessarily mean they were assisted by Zeller, but he could have had that, you know, that hockey assist where he gets it, makes the first pass, and forces the defense to rotate. So, yeah, those two pair very well together. We were kind of talking about this last year. Zeller and Batum paired well together last year. Now it's all Kemba and Zeller.
Yeah, and, you know, Richie, it's like when Zeller's in there, Charlotte knows where their offense is coming from. It's coming from the pick-and-roll situation, and they know that Zeller's rolling hard. And so there's one read as a ball handler in that situation. If you're Kemba Walker, there's one read. Where is Zeller's defender? Is he up? You know, what we were talking about earlier with the Isaiah, you know, Thomas situation. Is he up, you know, playing you aggressively as a ball handler? If he is, then you got Zeller rolling to the rim. Okay, the second read is, where's the health defense coming from? Is Zeller rolling free? Or is, you know, is a weak side defender sagging in? Okay, if a weak side defender sagging in,
which
I'm pitching it to the other side. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
But my point is, the Hornets know where they're going to eat offensively when Zeller's in the game. Like, they know the action that it comes out of. So it's just kind of like a repetition thing. Kim has gotten really good in that set. The rest of the team knows how to react to it. You know, that's when MKG's cutting back door when his defender turns his back to either go up and help to the other three-point shooter, or, you know, he dives in to cut off Zeller going to the rim. You know, the team just, they know where they're getting their offense when that guy, Cody Zeller's on the floor. If he's not, it is still very much an evolution for Charlotte offensively, and they've tried to plug Frank Kaminsky in there this year, you know, at the five and spots to see, okay, can we form some kind of synergy around him, you know, as the five to get consistent offense? And the answer has been no. And a lot of that is due to Kaminsky's, you know, inconsistent shooting, but you see a lot of over dribbling. You see the ball stick a lot, and that's because the Hornets just don't know where their offense is coming from when Cody Zeller's not on the floor. You know, and when he was out for an extended period of time this season, you know, we saw the Hornets struggle there. And if they weren't shooting it well from the outside, and Kemba wasn't just going crazy, there really was no offense.
No.
So, you know, having Zeller healthy is absolutely key. And, you know, his numbers just speak to his impact on this team. His total net rating on the season is 6.7, by far the best on this team. It's incredible. So, you know, I think, Richie, I don't want to go overtime on this segment here, but I do want to say this. And this might make you mad, and I know it's going to make a lot of Hornets fans mad, but back to my point a little bit ago about the Hornets just needing more legitimate rim protection, and then kind of link that to the fact that the Hornets are in cap hell. Cody Zeller is, I think his value is as high as it's ever been. I mean, I don't think his value dropped or really increased from last season, but he is a very, very tradable commodity. Now, you trade Cody, you know, with our lottery pick, you know, a package like that, you know, all of a sudden you open up a door, or at least peek around it, to what could be a different, you know, to shake up what it looks like a flawed roster, Richie. You know what I mean? Like, you could keep kicking the rock down the road with these guys, and the Hornets very well may do that and see if you can return to last year's form. But there's a situation that, like, there's a contract that I think would certainly attract some attention. There's a player that's certainly going to attract some attention. You know, link that with a draft lottery pick. You might be able to get some serious goods in return there, or at least a good, to organically change how this team plays. And I think they need that. You know, now, is that, you know, a true second cog offensively, or is that, like I was talking about a second ago, or is that some legit rim protection, which now changes the way you can defend as a team? You know, I don't exactly know what the answer to that is. I guess my point is, the larger point I'm trying to make is that those are the kind of discussions that this front office is going to have, and is already having, I'm sure, to try to on the fly kind of pull a rabbit out of the hat here as the Hornets are locked into this group. Because I think it's obvious that, like, the ceiling is certainly not the roof for this group that the Hornets have rostered right now. Do you kind of get what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. I mean, I he is my second favorite player on the team, but like you said, his value right now is at an all-time high. And if you're just going to stick it out with this core, you probably won't see much movement upwards, maybe past the fifth or sixth seed. But if you change things around, it can give us a little bit more flexibility moving forward and kind of change the course or direction of this franchise. I see it. I guess I would just have to see what was coming back for me to actually give my evaluation on it.
Yeah, sure. So, like, so if you look at the Hornets roster and you're, I don't know, whatever, another GM of another team, name your team. Okay, so I say to you, I call you, I say, hey, Richie, I am going to let you pick any guy on my roster that you want outside of Kemba Walker. Now, you take, obviously, you're going to take into consideration age, you know, the talent of the player, obviously, the contract details. Who is that guy that you want?
I mean, you might be right. You might be right. It might be Zeller, but it could be Batum. Well, no, not with Batum's contract. So, yeah, it might
I don't
be Zeller.
Think so, yeah.
It might be Zeller. I think you're correct in that situation. But I think as Hornets fans, it's hard for us to relinquish him, knowing how much of a success he had this season. But, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so it's just something to think about. I mean, you know, Zeller, he would be hard to replace. I don't think he would be impossible to replace. And I think that just getting someone more athletic, again, whether that's, you know, offensive shot in the arm or a guy who can really protect the rim, I think just athletically, it could change the way that the Hornets team could play. But so anyways, interesting to kind of keep an eye on and see what kind of conversations this front office starts having moving into the summer. All right. Oh, yeah, the last thing I was going to say is just the Hornets are going to finish outside of the top 10 in offensive and defensive efficiency. They were top 10 in both of those last year, Richie. So a pretty severe drop there. And actually, I'm going to look real quick. They might at this point be on pace to finish outside of the top 12 in defensive efficiency.
I think they're right at 12 right now. I think.
I think they are too. I want to look that up. So, and they're going to be right at league average offensive efficiency wise. They are Charlotte right now, 14th. So 107 offensive rating. And yeah, I think they have dropped. Yes. Oh my God. Yeah. Charlotte is now, after last night's game, they're 17th in the league in defensive efficiency. And that is hard. Now it's a log jam. You know, right there at 14, the Clippers, you know, Philadelphia and Dallas are all 106, and Charlotte's 106.1, so it's a little bit of a logjam, but still, Richie, that's that's really hard to fathom with a Steve Clifford coach team. They are now below league average in defensive efficiency.
It is.
Just let that sink in, you know?
He's
crazy.
He's never had a below top 10 defensive rating in his three seasons. Well, now this is his fourth season, but in his previous three seasons, he's always been top 10.
It's pretty wild. And certainly these last three games, we talked about it earlier, just it's just shooting practice for the opposition. And so that's – I did not know we'd have dropped that much, and certainly something that's going to have to be corrected in the offseason. How the Hornets go about that is a different conversation. Will be interesting. All right, Richie, let's look at some of the offseason priorities here. And I want you to kind of rank draft versus free agency to you. What's more important for the Hornets to nail as they go into this summer?
Can I say both? No, I mean, I would say draft. Sure. I would say draft 1A, free agency 1B, only because our options are going to be limited in free agency just because of our cap situation. Now, if you ask me about trades, maybe that would be like 1A draft, 1B trades, and then free agency as a number two priority. We just don't have a lot of wiggle room, but I think we have to make, you know, hit home runs in all of these departments when it comes to this offseason. So, yeah, I mean, the priority is kind of right there. But I guess draft would be my top priority. Focus on that. Try to get a good player. But again, we're going to be sitting at the bottom of the lottery.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think the draft is the top priority. Charlotte just needs something that resembles hope moving into the future. They need to get younger. They need to acquire cheaper contracts, you know, so this is why the draft's going to be important for Charlotte. You know, maybe the Hornets get lucky, you know, in the draft lottery, not looking like that's going to happen, but maybe they do get a better pick than we're projected right now, which would literally, well, I think this is the 13th best odds right now. But you know, draft's important for them. They got to get a player who not necessarily impacts the game right away. But they need a guy who I think that can be a serious contributor down the road. It would be nice to get a guy who can contribute right away. But, you know, this draft is loaded with young talent and a lot of guys that are not going to be impact players in season one. The ceiling is very high for these guys. But, outside of the top four or five, I think that the strength of this draft is probably a little bit overrated in terms of guys that can come in and impact the game on day one. But I agree. I think it is the draft. Again, in free agency, the Hornets had the full mid-level exception. I don't really know what that's going to mean. You know, this is the first summer that the mid-level exception is worth, you know, $7 million or whatever, you know, just shy of that. So it's, you know, it's worth a little bit more than it has been in the past. I don't know what that means for it. I'm not very confident the Hornets can get, you know, a big time impact player there. But depending on what they do in the draft, which is going to come before free agency, obviously, it feels like to me the Hornets are going to have to find a second score and, you know, a shot in the arm offensively with that mid-level exception, Richie.
Yeah. It's going to be a focus on draft first. And then, you know, focus or shifts to free agency. And I haven't done a very good job at researching all the available free agents. But I think sometimes with the mid-level exception, it's a difficult issue because I feel like players, free agents that are, you know, they kind of look at the other options first. If they can get more than $7 million a year, they're going to try to get that. And then, you know, if a team just has a mid-level exception, you know, a player is going to resort to that as their last possible option, I feel like. So we do have that full mid-level exception, which I believe is up to 4 years and gives us annual raises of 4.5% of the salary. And it is higher than it has been in the past, but I don't know. I guess it's kind of, we use it when the free agency pool kind of dies out a little bit. So it's hard to tell right now, heading into free agency, you know, who's going to be able to be used for that MLE.
Yeah. I'm like you. I haven't really been more wrapped up in the draft and looking at some of those guys when I can. But and we'll talk about possible targets for free agency as we move, you know, really into the offseason, which we're not quite there yet. But yeah, that's, you know, outside of that full mid-level exception, the Hornets, you know, they're already capped out. So that's going to be the only way they can spend this summer. As you mentioned, a possible trade is the other option. And look, just keep that keep that in mind. I mean, the Hornets are not locked in to pick, you know, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, wherever that pick lands. They could certainly look to move that pick, to move back in, into the you know, move back in the draft, maybe get a few first round picks that are, number one, going to be a little bit cheaper, and number two, help you fill out a roster that you're not going to be able to fill out in free agency because you don't have any room. And then on top of that, you know, what are the Hornets going to do with I assume they decline the second year on Ramon Sessions' team option. But, you know, I've had conversations with folks on Twitter and conversations in general with people that think they're going to keep him just because they, you know, they're locked in to their flexibility of where their moves can come from. So, you know, it's going to be really interesting. They got some other rights that they need to decide if they're going to renounce or not. But yeah, Rich, yeah, in the roster you're looking at today is effectively going to be what it is going into next season. All right. Very good. Anything else on as we kind of just glance towards the summer that you want to touch on?
No. I mean, we'll probably get to it in the upcoming episodes because that's where our focus is going to have to shift as we're out of the playoffs. But right now, I'm just kind of thinking about, you know, how our season ended and what kind of went wrong this season. So,
yep. So, you know, stay with us as we, you know, move in to May here in late April. We were really going to dive in on draft coverage, and we're going to have some really cool guests on the show that are nerds like me when it comes to draft prospects. And you're all going to get really annoyed reading my Twitter handle for the next, you know, 2 months or so, because I'm going to go into full draft mode. It's my favorite time of the year. All right. I love this stuff. And as a Hornets fan, it comes naturally because you're already locked into this, you know, every May, you know, leading up to the draft, where the Hornets usually have a pretty good pick. And so this year is not going to be much different. So, you know, just be aware of that. A lot of draft coverage coming from Queen City Hoops, a lot of draft coverage coming from BuzzBeat Radio. Coming up soon, Richie, we covered a lot. Final thoughts here as we close out the season.
I mean, I mentioned this on an article at Queen City Hoops. We won't really dive into it because we're running low on time here. But final thoughts for the season. I'm a little surprised that our defense took a dip this season. Like I stated in the article, this is the first year in which Clifford has had a below 10 rating, top 10 rating in defense. And I think a lot of that has to do with defending the three-point line. You know, over the offseason, we got to get Batum kind of locked in defensively, or we got to get someone that can play defense, because, you know, our defense this year has allowed a lot of three-point attempts, and a lot of it has to do with, like you stated, a lack of a rim protector, but also on-ball defense has been bad, and we've had to collapse so much in the paint where it leaves, you know, shooters open from three. So my last thought for this season, I kind of wish that we did make the playoffs heading into the season, and I had high hopes, probably, you know, December. You know, I even said it on the previous episode that, you know, it's looking like we could make a top four spot, but the defense just kind of let us down this year.
Yeah, so, yeah, I'm sorry, Richie. I told you I was getting, we were going to plug your piece, and then I got ahead of myself. But, yeah, so the piece that Richie was kind of just referencing, he wrote a feature article yesterday where the 2016-17 Hornets went wrong. So make sure you go and read that over at queencityhoops.com. It's got a lot of interesting nuggets just statistically of where the Hornets were burned this season and again, where it really went wrong. So make sure you go read that. Really good job on that, Richie. I enjoyed reading that. And it's, you know, not super long feature article, but it puts it in perspective very quickly, you know, and helps you in, you know, something that's very digestible, written content, helps you understand very simply, here's what went wrong for the Hornets. I mean, they couldn't guard the three-point line, all the other things that you talked about. So very nice job on that as we transition into draft season here, Richie. Folks, don't forget we are a member of the Almighty Baller Podcast Network. Again, go and check out all the great stuff over at almightyballing.com. They've got any kind of podcast. If you're a fantasy basketball guy, every single team in the league is covered. Draft, free agent, I mean, whatever you want, it's there. So please make sure you're going out and checking. You're going and checking that out. Richie, tell the folks where they can listen to us on the go. Find us on social media.
Very good. Yeah, you can follow the show on Twitter at BuzzBeat Radio, myself at Richie Randall, and you can follow Spencer at QCH Spencer. As always, you're able to listen to us on the computer or in the car. Visit queencityhoops.com for all of our content. And if you want to continue to listen to the show, search BuzzBeat on your podcast app or the Stitcher app. We truly appreciate any ratings, reviews, feedback as well. And I'd also go ahead and check out the Dash Radio app and be on the lookout for the Almighty Baller radio station, in which BuzzBeat will be a part of. We want to thank everyone again for all the support so far, and we're excited to keep things going. Definitely disappointed in how the season ended, but you know, you just never know. Things may turn around for next season. So, guys, we will see you next time.
Awesome. All right, folks. Well, until next time, go Hornets. You get to say that for two more games, and then we're off into the draft. So thanks for the listen. We'll see you next week.